Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today I'm joined by Steve Lewis. He's an architect of some note. He was on the podcast a couple years ago. In fact, he was one of the highest rated podcasts of all the podcasts that we've done. Steve brings extraordinary talent and sensitivity to the field of architecture. Delighted to have him on the podcast today. Hey, Steve, how you doing, man?
Oh, it's been too long. We're too close. It's been too long. No, I'm fine. I'm well.
Can you believe it's been a couple years since we had a podcast? Over two, actually.
That's amazing. Time just got conflated with all of the pandemic and all of the post-pandemic, and I think I've lost my sense of time.
It's true.
We're living in the space-time continuum, no doubt.
I think so. I did go back and listen to the podcast recorded in. It was in January of 2022, right at the height of the pandemic, and we had a great talk. We had a great talk talking about your childhood and college days and early career stuff, and ending up talking about Colin Powell and all that, the family connection and all. So I'm psyched to have you back on the show. And Steve, I don't know what it is about your personality. I mean, I find it magnetic, but you're like one of our highest rated podcasts that we've ever had. We have over 180 episodes now.
Oh my God.
And you're way up there. I don't know what it is.
I tell you, I mean, I'm humbled. And it's pretty amazing.
Well, that's good stuff.
A lot has happened since we had our last conversation, as you're probably aware.
Yeah.
I was a candidate for AIA National President and ran a very kind of wonderful roadshow of engaging with AIA chapter members all across the country and beyond, including AIA International, AIA Honolulu, and these chapters were requested audiences with the candidates, in which this case there were three of us who were running.
Yeah.
And when I got a phone call during the conference after the voting saying, "Oh, Steve, we're sorry you didn't win," I felt a great sense of relief, actually.
Well, it
became clear to me. I wondered right off the bat, I'm human. So I said, well, why am I not feeling, like depressed or, sad? And it was that my decision to pursue that office was one of responding to a calling, which I've always done throughout my life and career, which is of service, right? And yeah. I saw the state of affairs with climate change, with, how to transfer our knowledge to the next generation and all these important issues. And I felt that I was called to
raise them,
but it never was an ambition of mine to hold that office. I never had set my sights on it. It hit me rather suddenly. I tested, floated a test balloon, and a few people got a great response. So I threw in. And what was beautiful about it, Ted, was that my message and the manner in which I delivered it to all of those people seemed to resonate so positively. And I thought at the end of the day, I got that word out wide and far and wide and got so much affirmation, either in person, LinkedIn messages, just beautiful. Yeah. And I didn't have to sort of sacrifice myself to the grinding machine of AIA leadership at the national level, which is pretty intense, as I learned in greater depth over the course of that campaign. So,
yeah, and I would imagine, Steve, that you drew the pack in your direction, right? Right. I mean, if you had that receptivity with all the chapters to, hey, architects, we've got to get with it. Here's climate change, big as existential threat biggest we've ever dealt with. Do you think you actually drew the other candidates towards your position or towards that position?
Well, in fairness, I would say that the colleague who was successful in his run, who's now the president-elect, Ilya Azarov out of New York, is well regarded and renowned as a climate change guru. He has a practice that's very much focused on that. He is apparently very well known and very well regarded. So the interesting thing about this campaign was there were three of us, and we agreed on all of the big issues. So it really became a matter of, well, who does the membership think is going to be the best face of leadership? Yeah. I say that with lots of entendre, because there are some, you know, well, I don't even want to get into the kind of overtones that we're in a country right now that's very divided. AIA leadership, just by happenstance, is a Black woman CEO of a 90,000 plus member organization, that most of whom are not, do not look like her. Yeah. And the current president is the first millennial, the 100th president of the AIA. She's a young Black woman, was my mentee at GSA in 2005. And then she's ascended to this great office, elected by the membership. But with that comes the complexity of control, power, who has it, who's entitled to it, shall we say. And it's worth taking the risk of talking about it in this sense, just so that we are aware of the world and the country that we're living in right now and how high the stakes are in terms of our ability to join with each other, be united, which was the platform that I, you know, I did my Lift Our Voices Equally for Change. The Love for Change was sort of my moniker for the campaign. Nice. And and we have to find that best of ourselves and not succumb to fear and all that comes with fear.
Right? The paralysis. Well, Steve, congratulations for throwing your hat in the ring. I mean, that's a lot of effort. And even though you weren't selected, as you said, I've certainly had an effect. And I mean, I kind of wanted to touch base with you on a number of these things related to climate change and mm-hmm. architecture and sort of that interface, because, and you just mentioned it, that the new president-elect is, you know, really very well steeped or versed in climate change and the importance of climate change and the importance of addressing climate change. So how do architects, this is a very broad starting question, but how do architects address climate change, right? I guess they build stuff that is, what, more resilient? More?
Well, I mean, well, let me just say that when there's disruptive change within the industry moves toward meeting those challenges. When AutoCAD came around and hand drafting became arcane, everybody swung toward that because they needed to. And clients also have a role in motivating firms to move toward state-of-the-art best practices, et cetera. So the industry, the profession is in mass moving toward strategies that will maximize our ability to control how much carbon we put into the atmosphere, and not just, I mean, we're looking cradle to grave. You've seen the rapid increase in interest in mass timber structures. Certainly, and I do a lot of partnering with Quinn Evans Architects, who are known as for historic preservation. The most sustainable building, of course, is one you don't have to build. It's already there. You just, adaptively reuse it. Mm-hmm. So I think that for us, there are three main elements, I think, at ZGF that we're focused on. One of them is the expansion of use of mass timber. The other is the science behind lessening the embedded carbon in concrete, cement. And the third is seizing opportunities for adaptive reuse of existing structures.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about each of those just quickly. Mass timber, how tall can the buildings be using wood frames?
Yeah. I'm not going to pretend to be the expert, but I will say that it depends on jurisdictions and where, but I believe it's either in Europe or Asia, they're building like a high-rise mass timber building. It's curious to me because after sitting through some webinars and the people who are supplying these systems, cross-laminated timber, CLT, you know, the amount of additional fire protection and other materials that have to be joined with the timber to make it work really call into question the economic feasibility. Like, why would you, unless you just have the resources and are trying to make a statement? Mm-hmm. And so we're still, I think,
working through that,
working through the science of it. It's interesting to know that these large wood columns, when they're subjected to the fire testing, they get a char on the outside, but they tend to be very resilient beyond that char.
Very counterintuitive, isn't it?
It is. It is. And it's very kind of exciting to be, you know, they always used to say, and maybe still say, that architecture is the marriage between art and science. And we're being drawn away from the art more to the science right now, which will produce more honest buildings with integrity that are driven by the right set of criteria and needs versus necessarily the ego, which had been a big motivator for, you know.
I'm fascinated to hear that at ZGF, you know, your architectural firm, that, you know, lessening the carbon content of concrete is way up there. I mean, I've been researching that. I think concrete production is something like 3% of all CO2 emissions. I think steel production is sort of the same thing. Mm-hmm. So these are huge carbon emission contributors, and it's very gratifying to hear that your firm is saying, hey, we got to find ways of using less of that stuff, or different blends that has a different carbon content.
Yeah. And it's exciting to see the science that's going into different strategies, different materials that produce the same structural qualities, but with far less carbon impact. We have two colleagues in the firm, one in the LA office, Avide Higagi, and in the DC office, Arthi Gowda, who are our firm-wide sustainability expert resources. And so I'm actually... I offered to my colleague Avide in the LA office, since I have a little bit of dead time on the heels of the AIA election, and now my plate is kind of clean. I'm not really working too much on projects until the next one comes along that I'm called to. She was looking for some assistance from a more of a entry level emerging professional to do some of the metric filling out, using a software package to figure out, you know, the carbon impacts of some of the projects. And I said, well, why don't you teach me that thing? You know, you know, I believe in continuous learning. I'm 67 years old, but I still got to learn some new stuff today. So,
So you've got the embedded energy in the building, right? Or in the materials that built the building. And I really like your focus on the adaptive reuse and the, you know, creating buildings that last longer. I mean, what is it today? A typical commercial building, what, 40, 50, 60 year lifespan, something like that?
Yeah.
Whereas we've had cathedrals that have been around for, what, centuries, right?
Well, pyramids that have been around for millennia.
No. We have the embedded materials in a building, but then you've got the energy use in the building. I want to get your read on this, because we've been looking at building decarbonization, which is not so much on the embedded side, but it's the mechanical systems, you know, instead of having boilers that are boiling, you know, they're burning fuel oil or natural gas. Now we're looking at electrification. Do you think that trend is also, Steve, sweeping into the architectural industry, this whole decarbonization, just like we're decarbonizing our mobility, right? Our cars.
Yeah. Right.
We're decarbonizing our buildings. Is that also front and center?
Yeah, and we work closely with our engineering consultants. And a lot of this, again, is client-driven. I mean, and it's all a mashup that's a perfect storm of our own personal commitment and responsibility, along with the clients. We're fortunate to have many in higher education institutions, research laboratory work, things that by their nature might be energy intensive, and looking at strategies to offset or minimize that energy demand and energy use. And that's through solar, wind, and also, I don't think we've done much geothermal with our teams, but it
big potential
is,
there.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about wind, because some of the coolest things I've seen, I know this is the world of high rises, But I've seen these high rises where they actually create a vortex in the middle of the building and put wind turbines right in the building.
What? I haven't seen that one yet.
You haven't? I mean, I could show you some pictures. It's phenomenal. The building is literally designed to capture the prevailing wind and these large wind turbines. Another thing is that a lot of glass now, architectural glass, can have photovoltaics embedded in it still have some transparency.
Yeah, that's exciting.
And then the coolest thing that I've come across, I mentioned this to you in a note, is this Energy Vault, which is teamed up with Skidmore, Owens and Merrill? And they're actually going to have a gravity energy storage system inside a building that may be 1,000 meters tall, right?
Wow.
So on these super high rises that you could actually, during off-peak periods, you could raise up a huge cement block, and then during peak periods, gradually let it down, and the generators are going.
That's exciting.
Are we heading in this direction, or yeah. is that just the fringe stuff?
No, man, I think, we want to be innovators. Any one of us, would dream of waking up one morning with an idea, right, that could make a big difference and see it proliferate and spread. Some of what you're talking about is new to me. I haven't heard of it, but it is exciting. I know that ZGF's headquarters building in Portland is a tower, and on top of it, along the facade, there are a series of turbines that are not huge, and they don't generate, a huge amount. And for the time in which they were built some years ago, may have been more of sending out a visual signal to the world, this is what we have to do. So it really calls for and is getting a lot more cross-disciplinary collaboration in this period of innovation around energy. So, I mean, for me, where my expertise hits the road is in the adaptive reuse of existing buildings. I came up under my father's wing really doing that work in the Harlem community, where there were just tons of tenement buildings and old brownstones that architecturally were just gorgeous but had just completely fallen into disrepair. And our ability to go in and adapt them to a new program use. I call this my dad's Michelangelo project, because it was like 20 years of working in this one neighborhood and just to transforming it completely.
Yeah.
I go back now and all of the landscaping, the trees have matured and it's just this gorgeous neighborhood. Right.
Right.
But we would do it differently this time. We would look at a lot of the materials, differently. We would look at the energy systems differently. And so when you start to bring together the existing structure, which saves you right off the bat, the carbon that would go into building it again new. And then you can just layer on the energy systems use and the kind of optimum materials for the reconstruction and the interiors and so forth.
Tough to do, right? I mean, in many cases, tough to bring in sort of new age mechanical systems into a beautiful, historically, architecturally pleasing building, but that's the challenge at hand.
Yeah, that's a challenge, one that we welcome, it's good stuff.
What about, I want to just hit you up with a couple more of these concepts, but what about this whole notion of biophilic design and sort of creating this, a good friend of mine who I used to work with at Rocky Mountain Institute, Bill Browning, is a big leader of, he's a huge spokesperson, and this whole notion of creating these connections to the outdoors.
Oh, yeah.
And living walls and all those materials that give us the comfort, I guess.
Yeah, that's huge. I'm going to back up before I get to the answer to that question and give some context.
Yeah.
So some real interesting path that I've been on with ZGF for the last 3 years since the George Floyd incident, where clients got quote unquote woke. And as we been hired to design these buildings, research laboratory building here, chemistry applied math building in Boulder and back in your neck of the woods, up at University of Oregon, also at Oregon State, a collaborative innovation center building there. Clients are like, how can you ensure that the building you're doing for us, when it's done, will feel equally welcoming to all of our users? Because our faculty, our students, our administration, they come from all over the world. And like in, say, Corvallis, Oregon, it's a very white place.
Yeah.
And how can these people who are different feel like at home and welcoming and comfortable? And so I've led these groups now about four or five different projects through a process that in which I've learned quite a bit that when you talk about diversity, it's not just ethnic or racial diversity. You're really talking about neurodiversity and how people experience space differently. And it could be that you, Ted, come to the building on a Monday and you're in your feelings a certain kind of way, and to do what you need to do with the best of to allows you to be the best you are, you're looking for some privacy, some intimacy to read or to write or to do whatever. And then you come back Tuesday feeling a little bit more positive, and you want to be sitting at a bench with colleagues and, you know, getting information exchanged and collaborating. And so how does that translate into the design? It means that we need to have choice in the kinds of spaces that we occupy so that different types of spaces can satisfy the same functions just in different ways. And the other is flexibility. The ability to transform and convert and temporarily modify spaces to accommodate particular needs. There is the low-hanging fruit of seeing your culture reflected within that building, whether it's through environmental graphic design, storytelling through images that are projected, whether it's the cafeteria menu that has an international cuisine featured every week or whatever. So there are some kind of low-hanging fruit strategies. But ultimately, I tell the client, it is what you, by intention, program to happen within that building in that space that's going to produce an identity. So if you have BIPOC faculty throughout your university, you invite a weekly or monthly lecture in that space, and that becomes known, and students and others say, okay, we're going to the CIC building for this lecture again, you know, and it just becomes this place where it's a crosswords. The closest I can think of to the ideal mashup of people from all walks of life, including anyone ever lost in the Bermuda Triangle, show up on Saturday at the farmer's market. And that is like going to a game. You drop your tribal garb at the gates when you go to a Dodger game or whatever, and you root with the people next to you. You cry with them. You celebrate with them. They could be completely ideologically in different camps than you, but at that moment in that place, you're all together, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're challenged to think about ways in which we can sustain that once you leave the stadium, once you walk out of those gates. How can you, you know, provide an environment where people are reminded of how much we all have in common, and how rich it is to celebrate our differences and diversities rather than be afraid of them.
Right. I love this notion of neurodiversity. I trust this is the end of cubicles in the workplace.
That's neuro-suicide, no.
But that whole notion of having the choice of, you know, you're social at times, you need to hunker down at other times, but you need that diversity. And I want to loop you back to biophilic design. Is that?
Oh, yeah.
Is that fulfilling different sort of forms of neurodiversity?
Absolutely. I think it's been demonstrated pretty universally for all sort of learning types, all emotional types, that exposure to nature in many forms has a positive effect. And so sometimes that's bringing nature literally into a building with biophilic living walls, which I photographed a beautiful one up at Harvard, must have been about 2 years ago now, that is in one of the main public buildings on campus right off the square. I think this is unquestionable. We have an innate DNA connection to nature that really, and so what I have clients to say, well, we don't have the maintenance staff to, you know, maintain these plants. So let's take patterns and let's deploy them on our workstation furniture, on our panels, on walls, and it's just the pure imagery. Let's create window access to views and vistas of nature, which in Oregon is not a hard thing to do. There's just so much beauty there, and you just like if it's at the end of a corridor, you know, or wherever it is, you know, you take advantage of those view opportunities, and then create space around them that allows someone to come reflect and just sort of contemplate and kind of be at peace. So,
Hey, shifting gears a little bit, and I when I think of you, I think of your architecture as being sort of a lot having a lot to do with urban infrastructure. I guess I'm influenced by your work in Detroit, but so you're looking at whole urban settings, not just individual buildings. But Steve, what's your reflection on like sort of post-pandemic? I mean, how is this changing architecture? Are we finding is the downtown core are the downtown cores you know changing now? We're having more mixed use development. I mean, you even mentioned universities. I think about all the telecommuting that's happening now, all the online learning. How does that all fit in with the built environment that you're focused on?
Yeah, COVID was the most disruptive thing that's happened to us in recent memory, I guess. And the consequences of it have not all come to bear yet, which is primarily how the commercial real estate market will settle itself eventually. Leases are down, you know, tenants are handing the keys back to their landlords, and the landlords are going to the banks and renegotiating. And building owners that have footprints of buildings that are practical for conversion are looking at how to turn office space into housing. I mean, there's even an office building, I think it's in Chicago, where two floors were converted to pickleball courts, you know? I mean,
wow.
It's...
anything goes, right?
Yeah. We don't know yet, Ted. I mean, there's a lot of millions of square feet out there, and every tenant is paying for that square footage and the seats that occupy that square footage. And if those seats are empty, you know, and people are working from home, not only does that make a difficult case for maintaining that lease space, maybe you cut it in half and renegotiate, you know, in the case of ZGF, we have a whole floor. Maybe we end up with half a floor and we have a hoteling model and we have, you know, but we've gone back to a 4-day in office regime, not only because we value and need the interface between people, especially our younger emerging professionals just coming into the firm and the more experienced older people to be able to get that knowledge transfer going. But the deli, the sandwich shop, the pizzeria, the dry cleaners, they depend on footfall traffic in the space. And if everybody's home, those businesses aren't sustainable.
Yeah.
So that's
how hard is it to convert a commercial building to a residential? I mean, is it a plumbing issue primarily that you've got the plumbing usually in the center of the core and now you've got to disperse it everywhere? Or?
Yeah, that's a big one. All the, you know, mechanical, plumbing, electrical. There you go. MEP. It's you just have to distribute it where it's you know, think about a floor you have we don't have gender neutral bathrooms yet at DGF's office. We have a women's room and a men's room with a bank of toilets and sinks in each. That's all for a whole floor. And all of a sudden you have like 20 units on that floor, each one requiring its own service. It's tough.
Yeah.
And when you look at like, okay, so recently we were talking about General Motors is leaving the Renaissance Center in Detroit, which is the poster child identity of this downtown, John Portman, like Bonaventure-esque, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And those floor slabs are post-tensioned, meaning there are cables that are running through the slab that are tightened after they pour. You can't start drilling holes in that thing, you know. And so there is a element of basic feasibility. And so when they start talking about potentially demolishing a giant project like that, you're talking about huge environmental impacts right off the bat from the demolition and then the clearing of the site and the conversion to something new. So getting back to your original question, it's complicated. Maurice Cox, when he became planning commissioner in Chicago, commissioned a competition to looked at, I think, 12 or so downtown Chicago towers and came up with innovative schemes on how to convert them to residential use. I don't know what the outcome of that competition was. I have not seen it. I'm very interested in seeing it because your question is one that we all as architects are asking. But, you know, we don't know yet.
How do we make this transition? That's fascinating, the idea of tearing buildings down.
Yeah.
I remember there's a Joni Mitchell song, I think, about paving paradise and putting up a parking lot. And then, you know, there have been cities in Germany where they said, hey, we don't want this parking lot there anymore. We want to park here instead. Amazing to think that these structures maybe are not as permanent as we have in our minds.
Yeah. There's no shortage of, you know, wildly innovative architects who, and I believe in competitions just to draw out that talent and those ideas. And we might find solutions, you know, maybe drilling through slabs isn't the only way to get services to.
Yeah, right. Put in a subfloor or something like that. Or
you know.
Whatever.
I think we've got about, this is just me and my novice estimation, but I think we've got 3 years to start to really see the long-term impact of all of this, because people will be trying things. They've been trying them now. Up to now, they're going to keep trying them. And I think within about 3 years, there'll be an intersectionality between, you know, leases evolving and how much, you know, need there is, what you do with the leftover residual stuff, and how people are then drawn to come back together. If it's not for work, what are the things that programmatically can happen in a downtown to make it a place where people still want to be?
Yeah.
And you know, and is that enough to support the ecosystems of commerce that happen in a downtown?
Mm-hmm. Big, lots of change. I guess some buildings can have indoor agriculture in them. You mentioned the pickleball courts. That's fascinating. I mean, mm-hmm. They're really starting to rethink, is the roof better off being a garden, or is it better for solar, or is it better as a park, or do you try to integrate all those things? Steve, you mentioned in the last podcast that I think it's NOMA, the National Organization of Minority Architects, has an annual convention, and then you have a design competition in that convention. Are you still involved with that?
Just peripherally. In fact, I have a project that I'm doing in Anniston, Alabama. It's at a conceptual level that I was thinking of entering into the, it's now named after Phil Freelon, the Phil Freelon Design Awards competition. And it's an adaptive reuse of an old Coca-Cola bottling building to be the home of the Freedom Riders Training Institute. It's fascinating. But if you're leading toward a question of have the prompts for the design competition involved these matters that we're talking about of sustainability, of energy use, of carbon neutrality, et cetera, I hope so. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. But that's our future, is all these creative juices thinking about things that we never thought
Absolutely.
About. Well, you know, following on that, and my last question to you in this episode is, what advice do you have for young students that are interested? I have a nephew that's just fascinated in architecture. What advice do you have for young folks getting into this field?
So potentially the most disruptive thing for them will be how AI evolves over the next several years, because I believe that it's very possible that within 3 years, maybe five, I can sketch a design, scan it into the system, put in some of the variables in terms of the type of structural system, the type of mechanical, electrical, plumbing, whatever, put in the prompts. And within, you know, a half hour, I get out a 70% accurate set of schematic design drawings. That's labor intensive work that costs firms a lot of money, and we tend to have a race to the bottom when it comes to fees and trying to save money. So I could see a sad day when we no longer hire these young people and give them those entry-level drafting jobs, which of course is how they learn and develop to go to the next level. So I think the whole model of the profession is being disrupted right now. And so for me, and part of my message through my campaign was, how do we recalibrate the value proposition of what we do as architects? And a lot of it is focused on how do we fill these needs in communities with cities that need the kind of expertise and problem-solving skills we have to create environments for the future, environments that, you know, draw people together, environments that support commerce, that supports, you know, sustainable living, lifestyles, food. A quick side note is, may have mentioned at some point in our talking over years that Dr. Dixon DePalmier has written a book called The Vertical Farm. And it's really a great, it's older now, so it's probably the information's probably, you know, been updated, but it's the idea that we can grow extremely healthy food in an efficient way utilizing these high-rise buildings.
Yeah.
So I think that's an option. But my initiative that I would have championed or would have tried to champion if I had been elected as AIA president, but now that I haven't been, I have full clearance to build, is something I call the Communities by Design Corps. It's kind of an analog to the Peace Corps. It's modeled after a fellowship program that was up until about 3 years ago called the Rose Fellowship. It was under the Enterprise Community Partners nonprofit. And my idea is to resurrect that and to bring it over to the AIA's Communities by Design program, which now is in the Architect Foundation portfolio. They're the nonprofit 501c3 partner to the AIA, so we are able to process donations and give favorable tax treatment to donors, et cetera. And we've now got Communities by Design, which is an amazing organization, housed in that foundation. I was president of that board up until recently for 2 years, and create this legion of young people, giving them a fellowship opportunity after graduating to be sponsored by a firm, but positioned in a planning department in a city, or an affordable housing developer, or some entity, a community development finance institution, where they can learn the skills of community engagement, finance, other things that actually create a different kind of value when they then move a year or two from there into the practice. Because the drafting jobs, I think, are gonna be, you know, it's gonna be interesting to see what happens there.
But you still have that art of communicating with the community, that art of figuring out the client's unique aspirations for projects. It's maybe the AI takes over some of the science of it, but the art is maybe still what we have to shepherd carefully.
I think you're right. I think what it does, though, is it really starts to eliminate the numbers. I mean, we have never had strong numbers anyway, but it's really going to create this hierarchy of creative minds who then are given greater value and potentially greater earning potential, because you're eliminating all that expense of labor that used to go into producing the drawings.
Yeah.
And so it could ironically become a much more elitist realm again. Yeah. And that's scary. That's scary. So by giving kids an opportunity through this fellowship to ground themselves in service of some sort, then they're able to bring those values with them into the practice and help influence how their firms operate, where they work. You know, do they work in corporate America? Do they work in neighborhoods and communities who've been neglected for so long that could really use, you know, decades of attention? So
it's really about figuring out the meaning of design, figuring out the meaning of architecture, not just, like you said, not just learning the skills of drafting, which is AI is going to revolutionize everything. Hey, Steve, thanks for this conversation, man.
Hey, when are we getting together?
Next week.
It's a good holiday weekend, man.
Oh, yeah. So good to see you.
Always a pleasure, Ted. All right, man.
Bye.
Bye.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.